Chapter 7. Reisenfeld has kept his word. The courtyard is full of monuments and pedestals. The ones polished on all sides are in crates and wrapped in sacking. They are the prima donnas among tombstones and must be handled with extreme care to avoid damaging their edges. The whole crew are in the courtyard to help and to watch. Even old Frau Kroll is wandering around, examining the blackness and quality of the granite, and now and again casting a melancholy glance at the obelisk beside the door, the single remaining item of her late husband's purchases. Kurt Bach is directing the moving of a huge sandstone block into his workroom. A dying lion is to be created out of it, but this time not one bowed with toothache, but roaring a last defiance, a broken spear in his flank. It is to be a war memorial for the village of Würstringen, where there is a particularly belligerent veterans organization under the command of Major Wolkenstein, retired. The sorrowing lion was too much like a wash rag for Wolkenstein. What he would really like is one with four heads spewing fire from all its mouths. A shipment from the Württemberg Metal Works, which arrived at the same time, is also being unpacked. Four eagles taking flight have been arranged in a row on the ground, two of bronze and two of cast iron. They are to become the crowning decorations for other war memorials, to inspire the youth of the land to a new war. For as Major Wolkenstein has so persuasively declared, we must win sometime, and then woe to the vanquished. For the moment, to be sure, the eagles look like nothing so much as giant roosters trying to lay eggs, but this will be quite different once they are enthroned on the monuments. Even generals without their uniforms are likely to look like grocer's apprentices, and Wolkenstein himself in civilian clothes could be taken for a fat athletic director. Costume and perspective are important in our beloved fatherland. As advertising director, I supervise the arrangement of the monuments. They are not to be placed haphazardly in rows, but artistically located about the garden in intimate groups. Heinrich Kroll is against this. He would like to see the stones placed like soldiers in formation. Anything else seems to him effeminate. Fortunately, he is outvoted. Even his mother is against him. Indeed, she is always against him. Even now, she cannot understand why Heinrich belongs to her and not to the wife of Major Wolkenstein. Retired. The day is blue and beautiful. Over the city, the sky hangs like a giant silken tent. The cool of morning still lingers in the crowns of the trees. Birds are twittering as though nothing existed except early summer, their nests and their young. It doesn't matter to them that the dollar, like an ugly, spongy toadstool, has puffed itself up to 50,000, nor that the morning papers contain the notices of three suicides. All people of small, independent means, all committed in the favorite fashion of the poor, by an open gas jet. Frau Kubalka was found in her living room with her head in the gas heater. The pensioned government clerk, Hopf, freshly shaved, in his last faultlessly brushed, much mended suit, grasping in his hand four worthless Red Seal 1,000-mark notes like tickets to heaven, and the widow Gloss on the floor of her kitchen, her bank book showing deposits of 50,000 marks, torn in two beside her. Hopf's Red Seal 1,000-mark notes were his last banner of hope. For a long time there had been a belief that they would sometime or other be redeemed at full value. Whence this rumor came, no one knows. They were never officially payable in gold, and even if they had been, the state, that immune betrayer, which embezzles billions and jails anyone who defrauds it of as much as 5 marks, would find some pretext for not paying. Only day before yesterday there was a notice in the paper that these notes would not receive preferential treatment. That's the reason Hopf's death notice is in the paper today. From the workroom of Wilke, the coffin maker, come the sounds of hammering, as though a giant, cheerful woodpecker lived there. Wilke's business is booming. Everyone needs a coffin sooner or later, even a suicide. The time of mass graves and burial in canvas bags has passed with the war. Now once more one decays fittingly in slowly mouldering wood, in shroud or backless frock coat, or in a burial dress of white crepe de chine. Niebuhr, the baker, even in all the glory of his orders and fraternal insignia, his wife insisted on it. In addition, he had been provided with a facsimile of the Harmony Singing Club's flag. He was their second tenor, and every Saturday roared his way through Schweigen im Wolde and Und stolz weit die Flagge schwarz-weiß-rot, drank almost enough beer to burst, and then went home to beat his wife. An upright man, as the pastor said at his funeral. Fortunately, at 10 o'clock, Heinrich Kroll disappears with his bicycle and his striped pants to visit the villages. All this new granite makes his salesman's soul restless. He has to be on his way to let the sorrowing survivors know about it. Now we can become more expansive. First of all, we give ourselves a recess and are served liverwurst sandwiches and coffee by Frau Kroll. Lisa appears in the gateway. She is wearing a blazing red silk dress. Old Frau Kroll scares her away with a glance. She can't stand Lisa, although she is no prude herself. "That dirty tramp!" she exclaims with emphasis. Georg promptly falls into the trap.
"Dirty? What do you mean, dirty?"
"Can't you see she's dirty? Unwashed under all that finery."
I see Georg involuntarily grow thoughtful. Dirt is not something you like to think of in connection with your beloved, unless you're a decadent. For an instant, there is a kind of flash of triumph in his mother's eyes, then she changes the subject. I look at her in admiration. She is a general of mobile units. She strikes swiftly, and when her opponent gets ready to defend himself, she is already somewhere else. Lisa may be a tramp. She is certainly not obviously dirty. The three daughters of Sergeant Major Knopf come flitting out of the house. They are seamstresses like their mother, small, roly-poly, and nimble. Their machines whirr all day long. Now they dart off, carrying bundles of exorbitantly costly silk shirts for profiteers. Knopf, the old soldier, does not hand over one pfennig of his pension for household expenses. That's something for the four women to see to. Cautiously, we unpack the two black war memorials. They really ought to stand at the entrance and make an impressive effect, and in winter we would place them there. But it is May, and, strange though it may seem, our courtyard is an arena for cats and lovers. The cats begin to scream from the monuments in February and chase each other behind the cement grave borders. The lovers, however, put in their appearance as soon as it is warm enough to make love in the open. And when is it too cold for that? Hockenstrasse is a quiet, remote street. Our gate is inviting, and our garden old and large. The somewhat macabre display does not disturb the lovers. On the contrary, it seems to stir them to a particular frenzy. Only 2 weeks ago, a chaplain from the village of Halle, who, like all men of God, was accustomed to rise with the roosters, came to see us at 7 in the morning to order 4 of the smallest headstones for the graves of 4 charitable nuns who had died during the preceding year. As I, drunk with sleep, was leading him into the garden, I was able to remove, just in time, a rose-colored stocking of artificial silk that was floating like a flag from our last memorial cross, left there by some enthusiastic nocturnal pair. Unquestionably, there is something conciliatory, in the broad poetic sense, about sowing life in a place of death. And Otto Bambus, the poet schoolmaster of our club, when I told him about it, promptly stole my idea and worked it up into an elegy with cosmic humor. On the other hand, it can be rather disturbing, especially when an empty brandy bottle stands there too, gleaming in the morning sun. I supervise the display. It makes a pleasant effect, as far as one can say that, of tombstones. The two crosses stand on their pedestals, shimmering in the sunlight, symbols of eternity, hewn fragments of a once glowing earth, now cooled, polished, and ready to preserve forever the name of some successful businessman or rich profiteer. For even a scoundrel does not like to depart from this planet without leaving some trace behind. Georg, I say, we'll have to take care your brother doesn't sell our Verdenbrück Golgotha to some miserable farmer who won't pay until after the harvest. On this lovely day, amid the song of birds and the aroma of coffee, let us take a holy oath not to sell these two crosses except for cash on the line. Georg smiles, undismayed.
It's not as dangerous as that. We have to redeem our note in 3 weeks. As long as we get the money before that, we are ahead of the game, even if we sell at cost.
Ahead of the game, I reply. An illusion until the next dollar quotation.
Sometimes you're too commercial.
Georg meticulously lights a cigar worth 5,000 marks.
Instead of complaining, you should rather regard the inflation as a reversed symbol of life. At the end of each day, your life has one day's duration less. We live our life on capital, not income. Each day the dollar rises, but each night your life is quoted at one day less. There you have the subject for a sonnet.
That's a theme for Eduard Knobloch. I look at the self-satisfied Socrates of Hockenstrasse. Small beads of sweat adorn his bald head like pearls on a bright dress. It's amazing how philosophical a fellow can be when he has not slept by himself, I say. Georg does not move an eyelash.
What would you expect?
He asks me calmly.
Philosophy ought to be serene, not tormented. To mix it up with metaphysical speculation is just like mixing sensual pleasure with what the members of your poets' club call ideal love. It makes an intolerable mishmash.
Mishmash? I say, somehow hurt. Hold on a minute, you bourgeois adventurer, you butterfly collector, trying to impale everything on needles. Don't you know that without what you call mishmash, you're as good as dead?
Absolutely not. I just keep things separate.
Georg blows cigar smoke into my face.
I prefer to endure the transitoriness of life with dignified philosophic melancholy, rather than commit the vulgar error of confusing some Minna or Anna with the chilly secret of existence, and of assuming that the world would come to an end if Minna or Anna preferred some other Carl or Joseph, or if an Erna preferred some overgrown infant in English tweeds.
He grins. I stare coldly into his disloyal eye. A cheap crack worthy of Heinrich, I say. You simple connoisseur of what's available, will you please tell me, then, why you read with so much passion the magazines that are crammed full of unattainable sirens, scandals of high society, great ladies of the theater, and movie queens? Georg once more blows 300 marks worth of smoke into my eyes.
I do that for the purposes of fantasy. Have you never heard of heavenly and earthly love? Only a short time ago, you were trying to combine them in your Erna, and learned a sound lesson, you simple-minded delicatessen dealer in love, trying to keep sauerkraut and caviar on the same shelf. Haven't you found out yet that then the sauerkraut will never taste like caviar, but the caviar will always taste like sauerkraut? I keep them carefully separated, and so should you. It makes life comfortable. Now, come, let's go and torment Eduard Knobloch. Today he's serving beef stew with noodles.
I nod and go without a word to get my hat. Inadvertently, Georg has dealt me a heavy blow, but I'm damned if I'm going to let him know it. When I return, Gerda Schneider is sitting in the office. She's wearing a green sweater, a short dress, and big earrings with artificial stones. On the left side of her sweater, she has pinned one of the roses from Reisenfeld's bouquet, which must be extraordinarily durable. Pointing at it, she says, "Merci." Everyone was envious. That was a bush for a prima donna. I look at her and think, very likely there sits exactly what Georg means by earthly love. Clear, determined, young, and without affectation. I sent her flowers, and she has come. And that's all there is to it. She has interpreted the flowers as any intelligent person should. Instead of acting a tedious part, here she is. She has accepted, and there is really nothing more to talk about. What are you doing this afternoon? She asks.
I'm working until 5. Then I'm going to give a tutoring lesson to an idiot.
What in? Idiocy?
I grin. Come to think of it, yes.
That would be until 6. Come to the Altstadter Hof afterward. I exercise there.
All right, I say, without pausing to consider. Gerda gets up.
Well, then.
She holds up her face to me. I'm surprised. I hadn't expected so much from my gift of flowers. But why not, really? Very likely Georg is right. One oughtn't to combat the pains of love with philosophy, only with another woman. Cautiously, I kiss Gerda on the cheek.
Dummkopf, she says, and kisses me warmly on the mouth. Traveling artists don't have time for foolery. In 2 weeks I must be off. Well then, till tonight.
She walks out, erect, with her firm, strong legs and strong shoulders. On her head she has a red Basque beret.
She seems to love color. Outside she stops beside the obelisk and glances at our Golgotha. That's our inventory, I say. She nods.
Does it bring you any income?
So-so, in these times.
And you're employed here?
Yes. Funny, isn't it?
Nothing's funny,
Gerda says.
What about me, spending my time in the Red Mill, sticking my head backward between my legs? Do you think God had that in mind when he made me? Well, till 6.
Old Frau Kroll comes out of the garden with a sprinkling can in her hand. That's a respectable girl, she says, glancing after Gerda. What is she?
She's an acrobat.
Well, an acrobat, she says in surprise. Acrobats are mostly respectable people. She's not a singer, too, is she?
No, a regular acrobat. She can do saltos, handstands, and dislocations like a human serpent.
You seem to know quite a lot about her. Did she want to buy something?
Not yet. She laughs. Her spectacles glitter.
My dear Ludwig, she says, you can't imagine how silly your present way of life will seem to you some day when you're 70.
I'm not so very sure about that, I tell her. It seems pretty silly to me right now. What, by the way, is your opinion of love?
Of what?
Love. Heavenly and earthly love. Frau Kroll laughs heartily.
That's something I've forgotten long since. Thank God.
I am in Arthur Bauer's bookstore. This is payday for the tutor. Arthur Jr. has seized the opportunity to put a few tacks on my chair by way of greeting. I wanted to stick his sheep's head in the goldfish bowl that decorates their plush-upholstered living room, but I had to control myself. Otherwise, Arthur Sr. would not have paid, and Arthur Jr. knows this.
So it's yoga, says Arthur Sr., jovially pushing toward me a stack of books. I've put aside all we have, yoga, Buddhism, asceticism, omphaloskepsis. Do you plan to become a fakir?
I look at him disapprovingly. He is a little man with a pointed beard and nimble eyes. Another shot, I think, aimed at my beleaguered heart. But I'll get the best of you, you cheap mockingbird. You're no Georg. I say to him sharply, what's the meaning of life, Herr Bauer? Arthur looks at me as expectantly as a poodle.
Well?
Well, what?
What's the point? You're making a joke, aren't you?
No, I reply coolly. That's a test question for the salvation of my young soul. I'm putting it to a lot of people, especially those who ought to know. Arthur plucks at his beard as though it were a harp.
So you seriously ask a nonsensical question like that on a Monday afternoon at the busiest time in this shop and expect an answer to?
Yes, I do, I say. But admit it at once. You don't know either, despite all your books.
Arthur relinquishes his beard to run his hands through his hair. Good God, the things people think of to worry about. Take the matter up in your poetry club. In the poetry club, there's nothing but poetical evasion. What I want is the truth. Otherwise, why am I alive and not a worm? The truth? Arthur bleats. That's something for Pontius Pilate. It has nothing to do with me. I am a bookseller, husband, and father. That's enough for me. I look at the bookseller, husband, and father. He has a mole on the right side of his face beside his nose. So that's enough, I say cuttingly. That's enough, Arthur replies firmly. Indeed, sometimes it's too much. Was it enough when you were 25? Arthur opens his blue eyes as wide as he can. When I was 25? No, I still wanted to become it at that time. What? I ask hopefully. A human being? Owner of this bookstore. Husband and father. A human being I am, anyway. But not yet a fakir. He waddles away quickly after this harmless second shot to wait on a lady with a copious, drooping bosom who was looking for a novel by Rudolf Herzog. I quickly leaf through the books about the happiness of renunciation and promptly lay them aside. During the day, one is considerably less receptive to this sort of thing than at night, when one is alone and there is nothing else available. I walk over to the shelves that contain the works on religion and philosophy. They are Arthur Bauer's pride. Here he has collected in one place pretty much everything that humanity has thought in a couple of thousand years about the meaning of life. And so it should be possible, for a couple of 100,000 marks, to become adequately informed on the subject. For even less, really, let us say for 20 or 30,000 marks, for if the meaning of life were knowable, a single book should suffice. But where is it? I glance up and down the rows. The section is very extensive, and this suddenly makes me distrustful. It seems to me that with truth and the meaning of life, the situation is the same as with hair tonics. Each firm praises its own as the only satisfactory one. And yet Georg Kroll, who has tried them all, still has a bald head, just as he should have known from the beginning he would have. If there were a hair tonic that really grew hair, there would only be that one, and all the others would long ago have gone out of business. Bauer comes back. Well, found something? No. He looks at the volumes I have pushed aside. So then there's no point in being a fakir, eh? I do not directly contradict the silly joker. Instead, I say, there's no point in any books at all. If you look at everything that is written here, and then at the way things are in the world, all you want to read is the menu in the Valhalla and the family notes in the daily paper. "What's that?" asks the bookseller, husband and father, in quick alarm. "Reading is education. Everyone knows that." "Really?" "Of course. Otherwise, what would become of us booksellers?" Arthur rushes off again. A man with a closely trimmed mustache is asking for a work entitled Undefeated in the Field. It is the great success of the post-war period. In it, an unemployed general proves that the German army was victorious in battle to the end. Arthur sells him the gift edition in leather with gold edges. Gratified by the sale, he returns. How would you like something classical? Second-hand, of course. I shake my head and point silently at a book I have found in the meantime on the display table. It is called The Man of the World, a breviary of good manners for all walks of life. Patiently I wait for the inescapable shallow jokes about fakir cavaliers and the like, but Arthur cracks no jokes. A useful book nowadays, he tells me earnestly. It should come out in a large, cheap edition. Well, then, we're quits, eh? Not quite. You still owe me something. I lift a thin volume, Plato's Symposium. I'll take this, too. Arthur does some mental arithmetic.
It doesn't quite come out, but all right. We'll call the symposium second hand.
I have him wrap up the breviary of good manners, for I would not for the world be caught with it. Nevertheless, I determined to study it that very night. A little polish harms no one, and Erna's contemptuous comments still ring in my ears. The war made savages of us, but today one can only afford coarse manners if one has a thick wallet to make up for them. That, however, is something I do not have. Full of contentment, I step out into the street. The uproar of existence greets me instantly. Villy roars by in a fiery red town car without seeing me. I press the breviary for men of the world firmly under my arm. Forward into life, I think. Here's to earthly love. Away with dreams. Away with ghosts. That goes for Erna as well as for Isabel. As for my soul, I still have Plato. The Alstatter Hof is an inn frequented by wandering actors, gypsies, and carters. On the second floor, there are a dozen rooms for rent, and behind, there is a large room with a piano and gymnastic equipment, where variety artists can practice their numbers. The chief business, however, is the bar. It not only serves as a meeting place for traveling actors, but is frequented by the underworld of the town as well. I open the door to the back room. René de la Tour is standing beside the piano, practicing a duet. In the background, a man with a bamboo cane is training two white spitzes and a poodle. To the right, two muscular women are lying on a mat, smoking. And on the trapeze, her feet inserted beneath the bar and between her hands, her back thrust through, Gerda Schneider swings at me like a winged figurehead of a galleon. The two muscular women are in bathing suits. As they loll about, their muscles play. No doubt they are the lady wrestlers on the program of the Altstatter Hof. René roars good evening to me in a first-class drill sergeant's voice and comes over. The dog trainer whistles. The dogs throw somersaults in the air. Gerda wishes smoothly back and forth on the trapeze, reminding me of the moment in the Red Mill when she looked up at me from between her legs. She is wearing black tights and has a red cloth knotted around her hair.
"She's practicing," René explains. "She wants to go back to the circus."
"The circus?" I look at Gerda with new interest. "Was she ever in the circus?"
"Of course, she grew up there. But the circus went broke. It couldn't go on paying for the lion's meat."
"Was she in the lion act?" René laughs like a sergeant major and looks at me mockingly. "That would be exciting, wouldn't it?"
"No, she was an acrobat."
Gerda whooshes over us again. She looks at me with staring eyes, as though she wanted to hypnotize me. But she is not seeing me at all. Her eyes stare from exertion.
"Is Villy really rich?"
René de la Tour asks.
"I believe he is.
What people call rich today, he has various enterprises and a pile of stocks that go up every day. Why?"
"I like men to be rich," René gives her a soprano laugh.
"All women like that,"
she roars then, as though on the drill field.
"I've noticed that," I tell her bitterly. "A rich profiteer is better than a poor but honest employee."
René shakes with laughter.
"Wealth and honesty don't go together, baby."
"Not these days. Probably they never did."
"Only if you inherit it or win it in a lottery."
"Not even then. Money ruins character. Don't you know that?"
"I know. But then why do you consider it so important?"
"Because I don't care about character," René chirps in a prim old maid's voice. "I love comfort and security."
Gerda whirls toward us in a perfect salto. She comes to rest half a yard in front of me, rocking back and forth on her toes and laughing.
"René is lying," she says.
"Did you hear what we were saying?"
"All women lie,"
René says in her angel's voice.
"When they don't, they're not worth bothering about."
"Amen,"
the dog trainer replies.
Gerda smooths back her hair. "I'm through here. Wait till I change."
She goes to a door marked dressing room. René looks after her.
"She's pretty," she remarks impartially. "Look how she carries herself. She walks properly, and that's the most important thing in a woman. Bottom in, not out. Acrobats learn how."
"I heard that once before," I say. From a connoisseur of women and granite, how do you walk properly?
When you feel as if you were holding a 5-mark piece with your tail, and then forget about it.
I try to picture that and fail. It has been too long since I have seen a 5-mark piece, but I know a woman who can yank a fair-sized nail out of the wall that way. She is Frau Beckmann, the girlfriend of Carl Brill, the shoemaker. She's a powerful woman, made of iron. Carl Brill has won many a bet on her, and I myself have had an opportunity to admire her act. A nail is driven into the workshop wall, not too deep, of course, but deep enough so that it would take a good jerk by hand to pull it out. Then Carl goes to awaken Frau Beckmann. She appears among the drinkers in the shop, wearing a light dressing gown, sober, serious, and matter-of-fact. A little cotton is wound around the head of the nail so she won't hurt herself. Then Frau Beckmann takes up her position behind a low screen with her back to the wall, leaning slightly forward, her dressing gown discreetly wrapped around her, her hands resting on the screen. She maneuvers a little to get hold of the nail with her hams, suddenly tenses, straightens up, then relaxes, and the nail falls to the floor. Usually a little chalk trickles after it. Without a word or any sign of triumph, Frau Beckmann turns around, disappears up the stairs, and Carl Brill collects the bets from his astounded drinking companions. It is strictly a sporting event. No one looks upon Frau Beckmann's performance from any but a purely professional point of view, and no one ventures a loose word about it. She would beat his head in. She is as strong as a giant. The two lady wrestlers are anemic children by comparison.
Well, make Gerda happy, Renee says laconically. For 2 weeks. Simple, isn't it?
I stand there, somewhat embarrassed. The Vade Mecum for high society assuredly contains no rules for such a situation. Fortunately, Vili appears. He is elegantly dressed and has a borsellino on the side of his head. Nevertheless, he looks like a cement block draped with artificial flowers. With a courtly gesture, he kisses Renee's hand, then reaches in his pocket and brings out a small jewel box.
"For the most fascinating woman in Verdenbrück," he announces with a bow. Renee emits a small soprano scream and looks at Vili incredulously. Then she opens the box. A gold ring set with an amethyst sparkles up at her. She puts it on the middle finger of her left hand, stares at it in rapture, and then throws her arms around Vili. Vili stands there very proud and smiling, listening to the trills and the bass. In her excitement, Renee can't keep control of them.
"Vili,"
she chirps and then thunders, "I am so happy." Gerda comes out of the dressing room in a bathrobe. She has heard the scream and wants to know what's happening.
"Get ready, children," Vili says. "We'll be on our way."
The two girls disappear. "Couldn't you have given Renee the ring later on when you were alone, you show-off?" I ask. "What am I to do now about Gerda?" Vili breaks into good-natured laughter.
"Damn it all! I never thought about that. What could we do? Come along and have dinner with us."
So that all four of us can spend our time staring at Renee's amethyst, not on your life.
"Listen to me," Willie says. "Things are not the same with Renee and me as with Gerda and you. I'm serious. Believe it or not, I'm crazy about Renee. Seriously crazy. She's a magnificent creature."
We sit down in two old cane chairs by the wall. The white spitzes are now practicing walking on their front legs.
"Imagine," Willie explains. "It's her voice that drives me crazy. At night, it's fabulous. As though you had two different women, first a tender one and a minute later a fishwife. And it goes farther than that. When it's dark and she cuts loose with that drill sergeant's voice of hers, cold shivers run up my back. It's damned odd. I'm not a pansy, but sometimes I feel as if I were defiling a general or that bastard Sergeant Flumer who used to make life miserable for us when we were recruits. It's only for an instant, and then everything's straight again, but you understand what I mean?"
"More or less."
"All right. So she has me hooked. I want her to stay here. I'm going to fix up a little home for her."
Do you think she'll give up her profession? She doesn't need to. Once in a while, she can accept an engagement. I'll go with her. My business is movable. Why don't you marry her? You're rich enough. Marriage is something else again, Billy explains. How can you marry a woman who's capable at any minute of roaring at you like a general? You just can't help jumping to attention when that happens unexpectedly. That's something in our blood. No, someday I'll marry a calm, plump little thing who's a first-class cook. Her name, oh boy, is the typical mistress. I look with admiration at this man of the world. He smiles in a superior fashion. The breviary of good manners is superfluous for him. I forego wisecracks. Wit wears thin against someone able to give amethyst rings. The lady wrestlers get up lazily and try a couple of holds. Billy looks at them with interest. Capital women, he whispers to me like a first lieutenant of the Kaiser's time.
What's the matter with you? Attention! Eyes right!
A resonant voice roars behind us. Billy jumps. It is Renee, exhibiting her ring and smiling.
See now what I mean? Willie asks.
I see it all right. The two leave. Outside, Billy's car is waiting, the red town car with leather upholstery. I'm glad Gerda is taking longer to dress. At least she won't see that car. I wonder what I can offer her tonight. The only thing I have besides the breviary for men of the world is tickets for Eduard Knobloch's restaurant, and they, unfortunately, aren't valid in the evening. I decide to try them nevertheless, and to pretend to Eduard that they are the last two. Gerda comes in.
Do you know what I'd like, my pet? She says before I can open my mouth. Let's go into the country for a while. We'll take a streetcar. I want to go for a walk.
I stare at her, not trusting my ears. A walk in the country? Exactly what Erna, that poison-tongued serpent, reproached me for. Has she mentioned it to Gerda? She would be quite capable of it. I thought we might go to the Valhalla, I say cautiously and mistrustfully. They have magnificent food there. Gerda shakes her head.
Why, it's much too nice for that. I made some potato salad this afternoon. Here, she holds up a package. We'll eat it in the country, and we can buy sausages and beer to go with it. All right?
I nod silently, more suspicious than ever. Erna's reproach about the seltzer water, sausage, beer, and cheap wine of no vintage still sticks in my mind.
I have to be back at 9 in that stinking hole, the Red Mill, Gerda explains.
Stinking hole? I stare at Gerda once more, but her eyes are clear and innocent with no trace of irony. And suddenly I understand. What's paradise for Erna is nothing but a place of employment for Gerda. She hates the dive that Erna loves. Rescued, I think. Thank God. The Red Mill, with its fantastic prices, sinks out of my mind like Gaston Munch as the ghost in Hamlet, disappearing through the trap door at the city theater. Instead, the vision of priceless, quiet days with sandwiches and homemade potato salad rises before me. The simple life, earthly love, peace of soul at last. Sauerkraut if you like, but sauerkraut too can be magnificent, with pineapple, for example, cooked in champagne. To be sure, I've never eaten it that way, but Eduard Knobloch says it's a dish fit for reigning kings and poets.
All right, Gerda, I say casually. If that's what you really want, we'll go for a walk in the woods.